Hello and welcome to another episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Madad. Today I think we have quite a bit to talk about from the talks that are supposed to happen. Maybe they'll happen, maybe they won't happen. The possibility of the war resuming and a little bit about what our techno future looks like on the back of this war. Because that's quite interesting, and it's coming in the context of energy starvation that is being imposed by this war. And so we're going to talk through all of that on this show today. Let's start with where we are in terms of the fighting, or not so much the fighting, but with the Iranian blockade and the American counter blockade that is going on right now. We saw over the weekend a bunch of attacks by the Iranian Navy targeting ships in the Strait of Hormuz intended to maintain Iran's blockade. This came after Trump had first said that the Strait was going to be open, then the Iranians said the same thing. Then Trump said that, yeah, the Strait is going to be open, but the blockade on Iran is going to continue until there is an agreement. And so the Iranians rather predictably responded to that by re-blocking the strait and opening fire at a bunch of the ships that were passing through. I think it was two Indian ships and a third, maybe cargo ship, two Indian tankers and a third cargo ship, I think. Because when the announcement that the strait was opened happened, a lot of the ships that were trapped in the Strait of Hormuz immediately decided to make a run for it and try to cross before it would be closed again. But in reality, it just never happened. There was no opening of the strait. There was nothing of the sort. And then 2 days later, the United States blows up a hole in the engine room of an Iranian tanker that was trying to run the American blockade, the counter blockade on Iran's blockade, essentially. They managed to disable the ship by attacking the engines of it. And that's an easy thing to do if you're a sophisticated military like the U.S. Navy. And now we are kind of back where we started. And the idea from both sides seems to be to maximize the leverage that they have before any negotiations happen. And this from Amit Sigal, an Israeli journalist. He's saying that the current discussions for negotiations are that the enrichment of uranium would be suspended in Iran for 15 years. The Iranians wanted less, the United States wanted 20, so 15 was the compromise. But the enriched uranium wouldn't leave Iran. Instead, it would be fully inspected and be under constant United Nations surveillance through the International Atomic Energy Agency, which we know is riddled with Western spies who feed information to the West, because that's the purpose of pretty much all UN agencies. And indeed, it's not just the West that has its spies there. If the Chinese have people there, they're probably Chinese spies. If the Russians have people there, they're probably Russian spies, etc., etc. But then what would also happen is that some of Iran's funds would be released and sanctions on Iran would be lifted gradually. Now, for the Israelis, the lifting of sanctions is a bit of a disaster because it brings the regime back to life, really. And it means that they can spin a narrative of victory. And in any kind of narrative of victory, it is the hardliners who win, because they chose the difficult path and they chose to fight. And that means that they end up with the upper hand. And that means that the Iranians double down on the missile program. And one of the red lines that has been announced by the Israelis is that they don't want the Iranians to accumulate more than a few thousand missiles, which they already have probably more than that, because more than a few thousand missiles becomes impossible to intercept. And then the Iranians can take out Israeli infrastructure. And if we, as we've discussed a bunch of times on this show, when you're dealing with a country the size of Israel, you are dealing with a tiny territory with no strategic depth, there's a bunch of industries that are concentrated around here in the south between Dimona and Arad. There is an energy port here in Ashdod and in Ashkelon, and another one in Haifa. And then there is a massive urban area extending all along the coast, the Tel Aviv-Yafa region. And if you target those repeatedly, you just paralyze life in Israel. So the problem that the Israelis are trying to solve is their lack of strategic depth. They want to do that by expanding, but even if they, you know, do what they've already done, which is take bits of Lebanon and Syria and maybe try to take bits of Jordan, it doesn't solve the problem that this is a tiny space with very concentrated infrastructure and industry, and that it would be enormously vulnerable to missiles. Which is why what Amit Segal is saying is that the preferred outcome for the Israelis is this kind of no war, no peace, which is what had happened in Iraq between 1990 and 2003. If you will remember the Iraq War, the first one, Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, and this meant that its oil resources were essentially more or less doubled because Kuwait is so rich in oil. And that meant that Iraq could secure the Basra vulnerability that it had because it can only trade through a single port here in Basra and Shatt al-Arab. And with that additional space and these additional resources, Iraq would become a much more powerful country. And so the United States defeated it in 1990 and kept it in a state of no war, no peace for 13 years, with massive sanctions on the country that, you know, led to the death of, among others, 500,000 children, but which meant that the Iraqis were permanently paralyzed and that they couldn't rebuild their military. And slowly, the Iraqi state was sufficiently weakened so that the 2003 invasion could happen. And so what the Israelis are envisioning as a way out of this war in Iran is to really not reach any deal and to keep this conflict in, I don't want to say suspended animation, because it wouldn't be suspended, because the Iranians could still attack energy infrastructure, they could still attack shipping, they could still affect trade, they could do all of these things. And they would still be subject to an American naval blockade. And so what the Israelis are after are this becoming a permanent state of affairs, where the whole world's economy is held hostage by this conflict, by Iran, which is the party that's conducting attacks against energy, and by the Gulf states, which are the party that are permitting these attacks on Iranian infrastructure and energy by giving the United States military access. And so you end up in essentially an energy starvation scenario. Now, before we get into that, what's Trump doing and what's his view on all of this? Well, let's go through the timeline. At some point, Trump announces that, as a matter of fact, the Iranians are removing the sea mines from Hormuz, meaning that a deal is close at hand and has been agreed. And then he says that the Iranians have announced the Strait of Iran, not the Strait of Hormuz, is fully open and ready for operation. Okay, that means the conflict is solved, doesn't it? Then he says, but actually the naval blockade against Iran is going to remain in place until there is a full agreement. And that this should be very quick because most of the points are already negotiated. Somewhat confusing. The next day he says that if the ceasefire, if there isn't an agreement by Wednesday, in 2 days from this broadcast, the bombs will start dropping again. And then he says that the Iranians are attacking ships, which they were, and that wasn't nice. We are still going to negotiate, but actually Iran is helping us by maintaining the blockade, which doesn't make a lot of sense, really. His argument is that the world is buying a lot of more energy from the United States, which is true. We're going to discuss that in a little bit. And then he threatens again that he's going to knock out every single power plant and every single bridge in Iran. No more, Mr. Nice Guy. They will come down fast. They will come down easy. And if they don't take the deal, it'll be my honor to do what needs to be done. And then, to top it all off, Trump issues a video essentially calling for regime change again. Now, this is the familiar pattern of Trump saying that a deal has happened, and maybe it has, and maybe it hasn't, and then putting more pressure on the adversary and trying to get concessions that way in order to reach an agreement. But the issue is that this always comes at a cost. Because given the fact that the Iranians have been attacked twice during negotiations already, when Trump makes these kinds of statements, what the Iranians conclude is that he's setting a trap again. And that Trump doesn't actually want to negotiate. He wants to return to the war. And if you're Iran and this is your perspective, well, it's kind of understandable why you'd have this perspective, because you were attacked twice during negotiations. And so maybe the other objective is really, as Mr. Rothman here says, that there are divisions within Iran between the different parties, and the idea is to this is a sign that the regime is fractured and desperate. And I want to talk a little bit about the divisions within Iran, right? Because obviously there are different power centers within the Iranian establishment, just like there are different power centers within the American establishment or the Israeli establishment or the British establishment. This is kind of normal. But this division within Iran between the people who prefer negotiations, the diplomatic side, so people like the Speaker of Parliament, Ghalibaf, or the Foreign Secretary, Araghchi, or any of the others, versus the IRGC, now represented by Vahidi. These have always been the norm in Iran back from the days of the Safavid Empire. So the Safavid Empire was established in the 1600s, 1700s, and really was the prototype of the modern Iranian state, and it spanned a territory extending from Afghanistan to Iraq, essentially, with bits of Central Asia, Iran itself, bits of Armenia and Azerbaijan, that territory. And it was constantly in combat with the Ottomans, and it regularly allied with the West against the Ottomans. And this goes to a point that I keep on making, which is that Iran is a natural ally of the West, were it not for the Israel issue. Because Iran is surrounded by major Sunni powers, and as a minority Shia state, it needs external support, and it has tended historically to look to the West for that external support, including the Portuguese, the British, and others. And then the Americans, obviously, under the Shah, which it relied on to empower itself and fortify itself against attacks by its neighbors. Now, in the days of the Safavids, there was always a division between what were termed the men of the sword and the men of the pen, which is essentially today the same division that you have between the diplomats and the IRGC. And if you look at Iranian diplomats and senior government officials, these are incredibly well-educated, impressive men. You know, they're quite capable when it comes to their roles. And if you look at the IRGC guys, these all are graduates of the Iran-Iraq war. They're all veterans of the Iran-Iraq war, where the Iranians did things like send massive human waves to attack Iraqi minefields and machine gun positions and just died in huge numbers. So the people who rose to the top within the IRGC were the people who were sufficiently clever and fanatical to survive this, to first fight this war, and second, to survive this war. And these people naturally have different outlooks. And the way that it worked under Khamenei, the father, not Khamenei, the son, Mujtaba, was that Khamenei would always actually exploit this division. He would use the hardliners to make sure that the diplomats could get the best deal possible. And he would use the diplomats to soften the effect of the actions of the hardliners. So these two wings in the regime of the regime are typically in balance when there is strong leadership. And under Mujtaba, if he is alive, which is a big if, he has the authority to provide that strong leadership and provide and play the same game. So, yes, you are seeing divisions within Iran. They are obvious between the hardliners and the diplomats, between the men of the sword, or the men of the missile, or the men of the drone, perhaps most accurately, and the men of the sword, the men of the pen, I mean. But this division is normal for Iran. And this division is part of how the Iranian regime naturally functions. And it is reflected everywhere. If you go and look at, say, World War I history and what was going on in the chancelleries of Europe, well, it was always the same thing. The Austrian defense minister always advocated for war, and the Austrian war minister, obviously, at the time, because we weren't, you know, the West wasn't cucked then. And the Austrian foreign minister always advocated for diplomacy and peace. And they worked together, and they had their conflicts, and they were vying for the attention of the emperor. So this is normal, but it is really a problem if there isn't an emperor. And in Iran's case, the emperor is the supreme leader. And until we know anything with confidence about the condition of Khamenei, we can't really make very strong judgments on whether or not this is the regime that is fractured and desperate. Because in fact, historically speaking, this is the way that Iran is meant to work. This has always been the way that Iran works, with this division always present. So I just wanted to mention that by way of caution. What is actually unusual is to have the situation which the United States is in, where even the Secretary of State is a neocon and is part of a faction that always advocates war. That's unusual. That's the less typical thing, historically speaking. But in fact, the division that you see in Iran, That's actually what normal is like. You see it in Russia. Lavrov always advocating for diplomacy, always trying to find a new agreement, trying to find a new deal. And the guys in defense saying, you know, there's going to be fire and brimstone. And Putin sitting at the top, navigating the two factions. You see it in China. So what's abnormal is to have consensus over war. That said, the Iranians have taken a massive beating. And anybody who tells you otherwise isn't telling you the truth. And the concern for the men of the pen in Iran's case is that they don't know how the economy will recover if the war ends with the economy destroyed and them being placed permanently under sanctions in the way that they are now. Because they can't be assured that the Chinese or the Russians won't bargain the Iran card away in the same way that the Russians bargained away the Syria card. So the concerns of the diplomats in Iran and them wanting some kind of agreement, these are valid concerns. And the problem is that the concerns of the men of the drone, as I will be calling them, the IRGC, are also valid, because if they don't prove themselves on the battlefield, and if they don't somehow make the cost of the war so exorbitant that it cannot happen again, then actually they will end up like Iraq in the 1990s, and they will be getting pounded every few years, in the same way that Iraq was pounded every few years. And that's the dilemma that they're facing. That's the problem that they have. They cannot defeat the United States militarily because they cannot hit the American mainland. They could cause massive damage to American military bases, which they have done. And these bases were built up over decades, and the equipment that is there takes years to replace, especially some of the radar equipment. The AWACSs that were hit, that's a big deal. But this is not enough to actually defeat the United States. The most that they can achieve is to deny the Americans a win, in the same way that the Taliban denied the Americans a win. But you can't say, you know, and I know that sometimes my language isn't always precise, you can't say that the Americans defeated the United States. You can say that they defeated the United States in Afghanistan. You can say that the United States was defeated in Vietnam, but the United States didn't end up a defeated country in the same way that the French were after Bismarck's invasion, or in the same way that the Germans were after World War II. So there are degrees of defeat. And the kind of defeat that the Iranians can impose on the United States is a local defeat. The issue is, does this break the global economy so much that it does break the United States? Which is what the IRGC believes is going to be the case. So that's the thinking here, and that's the bet. That if the world economy is broken enough, then the dollar hegemony ends. And if the dollar hegemony ends, then the Iranians would have won indirectly, because we would be in a world where American sanctions cannot be enforced. And that would mean that the Iranians are free to trade with whoever they want, and therefore their ability to recover from this war will be much better than Iraq's ability to recover from the defeat of 1990. That's the division here, and that's the thinking here. And as I say, these are valid divisions. These are both valid perspectives. But the Iranians are stuck, and the Americans are stuck. Because if the United States goes back to war, the economy blows up, etc., etc., and we'll talk about that. So the position that the Iranians have taken is, because the blockade on Iran is still ongoing, and because the ceasefire in Lebanon isn't properly in effect, and this is something that I should have mentioned, on the 16th of April, Trump says that he forbids Israel from conducting further attacks on Lebanon, which is quite unusual. And you may ask yourself, well, how does he do that? The reality is, because he hasn't been able to declare victory on Iran, he's kind of declaring victory on Israel. But the Israelis just went ahead and pretty much ignored him, because the ceasefire that they ended up agreeing to allows them to do whatever they want in Lebanon, meaning that it's not a ceasefire at all, and it's not holding. Already we saw Israeli casualties happen in Lebanon. Hezbollah said that these were because of previously laid minefields, that they hadn't conducted a new attack. I wonder whether or not this is true, and whether Hezbollah is just being a bit coy. And so the Iranians are saying, we're not going to participate in talks because we don't think that you're serious about negotiations. And the way that they're getting out of this dilemma is by threatening Trump to continue their own escalation, and in response to the possible destruction of Iranian infrastructure and Iranian energy and power and things like that, they would do the same to the Gulf and deepen the global crisis. And I think here, you know, everybody is particularly stuck, but I think that the Americans want to go back to war. Because if the war ends now, the Iranians are the regional hegemon. And they can say to the Gulf states that, look, the presence of the United States is useless. It got so bad that the presidential advisor to the president of the UAE issued a statement saying that we're considering closing American bases, and getting paid a new one if we don't get, or the central bank separately said that they would consider getting paid a new one for their oil shipments if they don't get a fresh dollar injection. But it seems to me that's the UAE making threats that it doesn't mean to try to drag the Americans into the war. By showing the Americans the consequences of the war ending now. Because if the war does end now, then the U.S. presence in the Middle East is kind of pointless. The Iranians can shut down energy production and energy exports when they want, and they will still build up their missile program. They would have lost a lot on the nuclear side, stuff that they were willing to give up in the Oman talks, by the way. So not new stuff. But it would mean that the Iranians are the regional hegemon. And that's not a state of affairs that the United States is willing to accept right now. So I think that Trump is doing all of this to make sure that there is a return to war, but that he is able to blame the Iranians for it in order to justify it to his base. And I think he's saying things like, I forbid the Israelis from doing this and that, because he is very well aware of how divided his base is over Israel.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.